You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The drink today in my hotel room in Tokyo is instant green tea. That's because I'm sick. I've got a cold that's been stalking me since I flew out here last week. I'm here in Japan for a film project, but we will have a pretty sweet podcast episode from Tokyo coming down the road. Meanwhile, I've been thinking a lot about Issei and Nisei and Sansei, the first generation of immigrants from Japan to the U.S. and their kids and grandkids. That migration story is a big part of my family's life since my kids are, for their part, members of the fourth generation of Japanese Americans. Migration and mixing, man, it is what makes America great. For this episode, Nikki Nakazawa and I actually spoke a while back in Oaxaca, Mexico, where she lives. Her dad is Japanese American, which certainly doesn't define her, but is relevant because I think she's exhibit A of the upside of what she calls the dislocation of being the kid and great-grandchild of immigrants. It's part of what allowed her to dive into Mexico, make it her home, and get to the point she's at now, building a mezcal company that works for the small producers as well as it works for you, the mezcal-crazy consumers. I'm Nathan Thornburg, at least for as long as this cold doesn't kill me, and you're listening to The Trip, drinking with exceptional people around the world.
What brought you to Mexico City to begin with?
So when I was a student at University of Chicago, there was a study abroad program in Oaxaca. So I came down to Oaxaca in 2005 and was here for about 3-4 months and kind of totally fell in love with Oaxaca and with Mexico in general. And from then it became this minor obsession that ran through the rest of my course choices. And so I was able to study with some really great professors of Mexican history in university, and then decided to move here right after college. And then I had one of my dad's ex-students who was working at the Tamayo, the Contemporary Art Museum of Mexico City, help me get an internship at Turner and A&R Books, which was the publishing house that actually had published a lot of the books that I used for my thesis. And so I got a little gig there.
Okay.
And very quickly became an assistant editor. But as a result of like many weird and unfortunate things that happened to the publishing house.
That checks out with the timeline. You ended up being an editor, and was it all art books?
It was all art.
Uh-huh.
It was all contemporary art. And then the publishing house went under.
Okay.
And then I moved to another publishing house, which was Arquine. Mm-hmm. And I was managing editor, working with art, architecture, and design.
Something took you from the art publishing world to the point where you started working in food and you started running a company in Mexico City around that. What was that? How did that get going?
Well, after the publishing gig, I was working at this contemporary art gallery in Mexico City. And we were a small team, so I was doing a little bit of everything, which was great. There was a lot of things that I loved about it and was traveling quite a bit. But I just found this disconnect between this type of powerful work and the work that the artist was doing, and then trying to figure out how I was going to be in this world professionally.
Mm-hmm.
When I found that to be successful at it, I would also have to really rub elbows or shoulders or whatever the phrase is with the very wealthy of Mexico. And it just didn't sit well with me.
You were interested in powerful work, not powerful
people.
Yeah.
I decided, okay, what's my passport into another reality? And food seemed a really good one.
Oh, I was going to say drugs are great.
for
that, but
going into the underworld.
Yeah.
Yeah.
but definitely food too.
Food too.
It's very.
So, you know, especially right. living in a country like Mexico, which continues to be an agrarian country.
Yeah, right.
Let's work with food. Let's work with farmers. I have this wonderful friend, Emma Rosenbusch. She was traveling through Latin America. She made a stop in Mexico City. We reconnected after many years. We were just walking through downtown Mexico City and had this idea. We're like, you know, always really wanted to maybe open a restaurant or... And she had worked on all these farmers markets in California, and she was doing a lot of prison advocacy work.
Okay.
And we're like, how can we link all these things together? And
yeah.
From that conversation emerged this project called Pichon.
Okay.
Which was this farm-to-table pop-up, like the most millennial thing you can imagine, like that's in like Mexico City.
Hits all the notes.
Yeah. And we're like, yeah, great. Let's do this thing. I was still at the gallery, and... We, another friend, a mutual friend of ours, had just started this project called Yolcan, which was a sustainable farming project on the chinampas of Xochimilco. So the chinampas are these floating gardens, but really they're agricultural islands that were built during the time of Nezahualcóyotl. So this is in the 1400s.
Okay.
And it was the first intensive irrigation system of the Western Hemisphere.
Xochimilco is inside
Xochimilco
Mexico City?
Xochimilco is the southernmost delegation of Mexico City.
Got it. Okay.
And it has this now, like, you know, 200 kilometers of navigable canals.
Okay.
So we're like, yeah, but you know, no one else can do farm-to-table like this because we're going to be using these living ruins.
Yeah. That sounds like very difficult to pull off, just like you're hitting a lot of like narrow targets with how you're going to accomplish what you were trying to do. Was it?
Actually, it wasn't. It was, I think that we really didn't know what we were doing. You know, the name of the project is Pichon, which in Mexican slang, Spanish means novice.
Okay.
So we were a bunch of pichones. We like had no idea. I mean, we had no background really in food.
Yeah.
I mean, I had worked at some restaurants, but like
right.
every college student I think has. And, you know, she had kind of worked at some farmers markets, and we were like, duh, like, this is going to work. And it did,
awesome.
Which was crazy. But I think it was also just a really special time in Mexico City because Yolcan was, you know, just getting its start. And then also the Mercado del Cien, which is the 100 market.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first organic local market of Mexico City. So we had a lot of resources. Our first pop-up was in this fonda, which is, you know, a communal kitchen space in our neighborhood in Roma, and they rented us their kitchen space on a Sunday for 300 pesos.
Wow.
It's like $10. And we had like bought like, you know, 300 eggs or something, you know.
Right.
So we did this kind of American brunch, our first pop-up.
Using products from the Aztec floating gardens.
And from other local producers.
Got it.
So that was our first event. And at that first event, one of my dear friends, he had just opened up this restaurant called Café Cena. It was this one long communal table in San Miguel Chapultepec. And was like, you guys should just use the space on Sundays. And so that was our second location, and we started using that location initially once a month and then every week for about a year. And
so it became a pop-up within an established restaurant.
Exactly.
So you were ideating this. You had the reckless enthusiasm that got it off the ground. Were you also now cooking? Was this part of where you were more front of the house? Does the pop-up have a front of the house?
I was initially kind of coordinating all the things. Kenny was cooking. Emma and I were like administrating, doing front of house, doing kind of a little bit of everything. And then eventually I was also cooking.
I mean, did it feel at that point that that was for you? Could you tell this was sort of changing your trajectory and you were going to be off in this direction from then on?
I don't really remember.
Yeah.
All I know is that I think it must have been about 2 months into the pop-up I quit my job, and we managed to make it work.
I mean, that's also part of the attraction of living in Mexico to, it just seems like there's more freedom. I mean, frankly, mm-hmm. life is just a bit cheaper. You can have a crazy idea and try to execute it, and if it doesn't work, then, you know, you're still kind of making your way around. It feels like part of the Mexican dream.
For sure. I mean, I think that it obviously depends on what class you're coming from. But yeah. In my case, certainly the freedom and the ability to make things work with not a whole lot of money.
Yeah.
And maybe not a lot of money, but a lot of social capital.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can make those friendships and those relationships really work for you. And again, like, this is really a story of a lot of things aligning, a lot of people's projects aligning.
Yeah.
You know, it was a lot of serendipity. And also, I think that everybody's kind of a hustler in Mexico City or in Mexico in general. Everybody wears multiple hats. And yeah. I think it's just a more human way of looking at people and their full complexity rather than, you know, understanding each individual as a specialist in this tiny little thing.
Yeah. Since we're talking about that, I wanted to talk about your background a little bit too. Your background's connected to what brought you to Latin America in the first place. Your mother's actually was born in Uruguay, is that right?
Yes.
And your father is many, many generations Japanese American.
Yeah.
So what was it about, like, the way that they raised you that made you the kind of person who's just going to go and be in Mexico for what seems like an eternity, or at least a decade and change?
Yeah. My family is a product of a lot of displacement, both voluntary and involuntary. So we're quite small as a group. And so there isn't, I don't have this like big weight of place.
Yeah.
Which then becomes, you know, a search for place, right? So on the one hand, you know, not having been particularly rooted in any location has freed me up to find another home. And I think that both my parents really understand that. And at 16, my mom was like, you know, you should go learn Spanish. And she really encouraged me.
So you didn't grow up speaking in the home?
I did not.
Huh.
Yeah, there was various factors.
Yeah.
I was raised in a home with my paternal grandmother.
Mm.
And I think my mom didn't want to isolate her.
Yeah.
And, you know, for whatever reasons that she had, she didn't teach us Spanish in the home, although we were around it.
Yeah.
I was stubbornly was like, okay, you know, if I'm going to be different,
yeah,
especially within the context of, you know, like a white American suburb,
yeah,
then might as well.
This is up in Boston area?
Yeah, in the Boston area. I might as well, you know, substantiate it with something.
Yeah.
So that something was going to be me speaking Spanish.
There's a great little punk band in Mexico City called Sierra Madre. Half of them are Japanese Mexicans.
Know.
And I was talking to them about being Japanese in Mexico City. And, you know, they've been there for generations. I guess it's some echo of the larger populations that you see in Peru or Brazil. You know, it's kind of around that time. And they were like, yeah, I don't care. They call us chinos. Like, it's just what they do. It's mm-hmm. fine. It's just part of the language or something. I mean, obviously, your last name is Japanese. How do people kind of respond to it here in Mexico?
I felt such a huge relief coming mm-hmm. to Mexico and being called, like, a chino. Because it was like, oh, I get to be a generic, like, foreigner or a generic outsider rather than a specific one.
Right.
It just felt like such an oppressive discussion to be having constantly in the States about, like, okay, so, you know, being Uruguayan means this, or, you know,
right,
being Japanese means this. Like, you don't know me. And
yeah.
And also, like, each culture and each, it's all so different. Like, you don't know what part of Uruguay and the background of my grandparents and their parents, and then,
mm-hmm.
you know, the different parts of Japan that my ancestors came from and
right.
the circumstances under which they came, migrated to the States is different than someone else's. And
mm-hmm.
so just to feel kind of like people projecting this like opaque vision of what your identity is supposed to be in the States, and then coming here and it just being like, oh, whatever, you know.
And it's not a conversation that traps you.
Oh, it doesn't. It's
because you're just like, right, sure, chino, like, yeah, whatever, I'm moving on with my day.
Exactly.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but it's true. Like, identity gets so, it's so political.
And it's not that I'm not interested in,
yeah.
in those conversations. I just think they're, you know, they're very personal.
Yeah.
To engage with a stranger on that level,
mm-hmm.
it feels really invasive.
And here, right, it's just a completely different mentality. as you can tell.
And I get to pass in a certain way. Mm-hmm. Like I get to kind of vague Latin American, whatever, we don't know. But like, I kind of get to just fly under the radar a bit.
Yeah.
Which has given me space to explore other things.
Yeah. Do you feel like you are understood less as an American because of your passing? And is that good, bad?
I feel like in Mexico City, I was passing quite a bit as it's just, you know, I've been in Mexico City for so long now that like people are like, oh, you get it. So I don't know whether that's me passing as Mexican or just people understanding, okay, she's an American who's been here for a long time. So no, she understands certain things. We don't have to do the whole thing anymore. I think that in Oaxaca, something that's maybe been slightly exacerbating is just how people present themselves. You know, oh yes, we're here in Oaxaca, the land of great traditions and the moles and the music and the folkloric dance. And don't you love our crafts? You know, I'm like, yes, 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 yeah. I've been through this.
Right.
Can we get to the next the next level now where you're not telling me about the mole?
Right.
But, you know.
That's interesting, right? Because it is true about Oaxaca, but Oaxaca is also a much more interesting place than just that, you know.
Of course it is.
How did you end up coming down here, and what are you doing here?
I made the decision to move to Oaxaca because I have a mezcal company, which is now really an aguardiente de agave company because we've decided not to pursue the denomination of origin. But
because you will get taxed?
It's not about taxation. It's about the different steps we have to take to get the certification.
Yeah.
And it's quite expensive and labor intensive, and it is prohibitive for some of our producers. So we've decided to take this other route.
Are your producers pissed? I mean, they've been making mezcal for presumably generations. I've heard echoes of this where it's just like, we're now being, whether it's charged or made to jump through hoops in order to make or represent that you make the thing you've been making for forever.
Sure. I mean, I think that within the communities themselves, it's not like anybody's going to tell them they can't call what they make mezcal.
Right.
It's more of a commercial strategy, which mm-hmm. they understand.
Yeah.
When you look at all the taxation and, you know, the alcohol taxes in Mexico are about 53%. So when you then add on all of the additional fees for the Comercam, which is the institute that oversees the denomination, it becomes very expensive.
They oversee mezcal.
They oversee specifically mezcal.
So you can make the same stuff, but just by calling it aguardiente de agave.
And nothing changes. The liquid is exactly the same.
Yeah.
It's literally just the ability to market it as mezcal
mm-hmm.
and put the word mezcal on the bottle.
Right. But you are not looking to sell to Sam's Club anyway.
No, certainly not. And I would hope, and part of the work that we've been doing along with many, many other people is making it so that the consumer understands, okay, yes, it says aguardiente de agave on the bottle, but I know that this is mezcal.
Mm-hmm.
And making it so that people are educated enough to understand that and understand the product and the quality of the product as it stands on its own.
You started this mezcal company with a few partners from Mexico City?
No. So my business partner is this guy, Max Rosenstock. He mm-hmm. is from New Mexico.
Okay.
And had been living in Oakland for, I want to say, maybe the past 10 years.
Yeah.
And he started coming down to Oaxaca around 2010, 2011, I believe, and just got into it. And he was riding around in his car and asking around for mezcal and had the great fortune of encountering some of the producers that we're currently working with in the Sierra Sur of Oaxaca. So this is right by Mihuatlan along the southern mountain range. So he just hit gold because really this is now after having tried many mezcals all over Oaxaca, this is really, I can say, my favorite region for mezcal. He just started bringing all this mezcal by the house because he was friends with my ex-boyfriend. as I was producing all these food events, he would be coming through California, making a stop in Mexico City on his way towards Oaxaca, and back and forth, staying with us, leaving mezcal. Eventually, started asking me whether I would help him produce some events,
yeah,
where he could sell some mezcal and help fund some of these research trips.
Mm-hmm.
And so I happily obliged, and we started throwing these little speakeasy parties.
In Mexico City.
In Mexico City.
Yeah. I mean, we talk a lot about now the growing American thirst for mezcal, but Mexico City was really where the market began, right? In terms of, like, they were the ones who first were able to create this demand, and it's like a very mezcal loving town, right?
Yeah, I mean, although surprisingly people still know almost nothing about mezcal, even in Mexico City.
Really?
But I guess there was the creation of some of the first mezcalerias,
mm-hmm,
with a little bit more of a serious mezcal list in,
yeah,
Mexico City, and the formation of some of these the most important mezcal club in Mexico City, which is the Logia de Mezcolatras. So this guy,
very fancy name.
Yeah. So it's this kind of like secret, not super secret, but
yeah,
kind of club of mezcal lovers, and there's, you know, some rules and guidelines. And
what, how would you translate that? The
mezcal lovers mafia, or like.
There it is. Okay.
Or legion, the legion of mezcal lovers.
That. They were sort of setting the tastes, forming the kind of ideas of how you taste mezcal and,
yes,
like how you compare them, and.
Yeah, and they were generating a lot of the concepts and the vocabulary that,
uh-huh,
that people in traditional mezcal are using. And they were creating a lot of the framework for the battle,
yeah,
rounds of,
yeah,
mezcal and the discussions around the denomination of origin.
And how long ago was this?
This was around 2005, 2006.
Okay, yeah.
And then, you know, really the boom started in 2008. And that's even in Oaxaca.
Mm-hmm.
Although there was obviously things happening before then, but in terms of the,
yeah,
the mezcaleria,
yeah,
as the space of learning,
right,
about mezcal,
mm-hmm,
that was around that time.
You started doing pop-ups in Mexico City, and obviously this is something of a tide that can carry a lot of ships. I don't think anybody would say it's crazy to invest your time in trying to figure out how to do this and do it well, because clearly, you know, this market's here for a while. How did you go from that to, like, deciding, all right, you're going to start to create a brand with this guy?
I think actually it was for a very practical reason. He, uh-huh, actually needed another partner in his sociedad, in the formation of the company. And he asked me, and I was like, yeah, that's great. I would love to have a mezcal brand.
Yeah.
Without really knowing, you know, what it would imply and how long it would take to get to the point where we might be able to sell anything,
yeah,
legally.
Yeah.
So that was in 2014, 2015.
Yeah.
So we formed the company in 2015 and kind of slowly worked through some marketing stuff, some legal stuff, and now we're going through the licensing part.
Yeah.
But, you know, basically nothing had happened on the licensing front for years, and,
yeah,
that's why I'm here. Because
in Oaxaca,
yeah, because it's very difficult to work alone, and Max was here alone,
yeah,
sorting out a lot of things, and also moving, shuttling between California and Oaxaca, and he also this past year decided to move to Oaxaca.
Got it.
So it was like, okay, you're making the commitment to move to Oaxaca, then I'll move to Oaxaca, and then let's get this done.
Yeah,
because it wasn't going to happen any other way.
Now, so to play devil's advocate, to be, you know, kind of a couple Americans setting up a mezcal brand seems like it might be the pointy end of the spear. I mean, there's this huge, you know, boom that's causing pressure in unexpected and odd ways for producers and probably for the local economy. How do you go about doing it the right way? Or what do you see as some of the things that need to be done to make it like a good kind of business and not a gold rush kind of business?
Well, honestly, I think that mezcal, it's going to be difficult to make it a gold rush type of situation unless you're coming at it with a huge amount of money. But even then, it's a difficult situation with the producers because this, you know, This is something that's attached to a way of life, a subsistence farming way of life. So it's not like you have producers with hectares and hectares and hectares of agave that's just ready for harvest and that you can just process and get done with. The lifespan of the plants themselves is quite long. So if we're talking about even Espadín, which is a cultivated varietal, we're talking a minimum of 3, 4, 5 years mm-hmm. for the plant to be ready for harvest.
These are not grapes.
Yeah, it's not grapes.
It goes up to like 30 years, right?
For some of them. Up to 30 years.
Yeah.
There's a lot of patience involved. And within the context of the commercialization of mezcal, there's always been the figure of the intermediary. So I don't feel like we're doing something that the product itself doesn't demand. So like any other product that's coming from an agricultural community, like whether it's milk or corn or chiles or calabaza, whatever, if it's not consumed within the community itself or traded,
yeah.
there's always been this figure of the intermediary who brings it to market.
Mm-hmm.
And so historically in Oaxaca, that figure has been the expendio. So these people who buy mezcal in bulk, and then they have their little storefronts in Oaxaca where they resell.
Yeah. Are these the guys who were making, like, mezcal cream?
Yes.
Oh, no.
But before then, it wasn't mezcal cream. It was, you know, there was actually mezcal being sold.
I have a lot of questions about cream of mezcal.
I don't even know how they make it. I feel like there's, like, a lot of hydrogenized oil or something.
Oh, it's an amazing thing. It's like somebody's like taken this incredible spirit mezcal and tried to make some fucking Baileys out of it.
Yeah,
and really, they just sell it everywhere in Oaxaca City.
It's truly gross.
Yeah. So.
But yeah. So you know how I see it as a trying to be a responsible brand.
Yeah.
Is actually trying to present ourselves not as a brand. So I'm not looking for like brand recognition.
Mm-hmm.
In the way that you know people drink Padron or
right.
Hennessy,
yeah.
it's like you understand. Okay, like Neta, which is the name of our brand,
yeah.
or Mezcaloteca, or Quiche, or Archivo Maguey. These are the guardians of these projects or these agaves or these producers.
Yeah.
So we're quote unquote curating, which mm-hmm. sounds maybe a little pretentious, but we're merchants. We're selling what we consider the best.
Yeah,
shit.
Right. You're a storefront, whether or not you actually have a physical location. That's
exactly.
That's the basic idea.
That's the basic idea. So
like we run a wine shop. Here's the best wines you can
exactly.
get.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
And that's how mezcal, I think, functions. What my goal is and what I'd love is for people to understand, have brand recognition to the level of, okay, these are the good brands. These are the good projects. So maybe I know nothing about mezcal, but I'm going to buy from Neta because I know that they take care of the product and that they're choosing really excellent mezcals and,
yeah.
you know, they're working ethically.
You know, you're talking about doing responsibly. There are companies with a huge amount of money who are coming in and they're buying all the product they can kind of get their hands on and who knows, maybe mm-hmm. they're cutting it with some weird shit or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, like there's nothing that people won't do to meet an American demand. So that's out there. But you guys, you know, you had mentioned a few of these players in Oaxaca who are kind of, I don't know, artisanal sounds a little goofy, but mm-hmm. essentially just trying to protect a certain way of making and selling mezcal. That's a pretty strong community here, right? There's like a yeah. mission behind it.
Absolutely. And this is actually something that's been in the works. A few of these players in Oaxaca is really creating standards. So all of us collectively sticking to mm-hmm. certain types of standards of production and ethics and sustainability. So there are a few different players. And again, I think that this all started to come together about like 2005, 2006, 2007,
yeah.
2010, all these mezcal projects emerging, all in defense of traditional mezcal and all in the interest of the consumer being able to walk into a bar and say, you know, I want this varietal of maguey rather than I want this brand
right.
of mezcal.
For you, what is the most important thing in ethics? Like what's the thing that big guys or the kind of multinationals are getting wrong about the ethics of mezcal?
I think that a mistake is to forget that really mezcal is tied into this way of life. So it's not a product in the traditional sense. It's something that's tied to the land,
mm-hmm.
And it's tied to certain life cycles.
Yeah.
So again, like a lot of these farmers aren't making mezcal year round as their main source of income. It's not like a monocrop. They produce as much mezcal as their land will allow. We are the beneficiaries of this way of life. And so it's difficult in terms of the pressure around agave. There are people who are selling shit tons of agave from Oaxaca to Jalisco for the production of tequila.
Right.
Which
is just like not where Oaxaca agave should go.
No, it's not. But but you know, again, there's going to be your farmer in need who will make a decision to sell whatever agave they have to the highest bidder.
Right.
And the producers or the commercializers from Jalisco certainly have a lot more money on hand than people in Mezcal.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. So it's the tequila traffickers who are the biggest concern. For like the super simplified breakdown version, tequila and mezcal are made from the same, I don't know, is it species, genus of plant?
Yeah, so they're both made from agave.
Yeah.
Tequila is blue agave, and then mezcal is made out of about 14 different species of agave and subvarietals.
Yeah, the thing that is sort of sends a cold shudder through the spine of everybody who cares about mezcal is that tequila had turned blue agave into this kind of like the ultimate monocrop. There's no place in that industry for the kind of artisanal or kind of varietal intelligence that is part of mezcal.
Yeah, and Jalisco really was a state with, you know, some of the most wonderful varietals of agave. And now, you know, it's obviously become quite limited.
So where do you see Neta, like, in 5 years?
Well, I'd like to see a different type of commercialization around mezcal. I think it's really important for people to understand the diversity of mezcal, but at the same time, I think this idea that a mezcaleria in another country or outside of Oaxaca or outside of Mexico should include like 160 varietals is maybe a little absurd.
So you want to rein in the kind of like precociousness
of... Well, the kind of like mania around like having all the things, but understanding that maybe what's more valuable and valuable for the culture of mezcal is to build a relationship with a producer or a project that can actually reinvest some of that money in a meaningful way. So if you buy a whole lot of a mezcal that you really love and you do that every year or twice a year, then you build your own collection of mezcal. Let me have a relationship with this producer in the Sierra Sur, this other producer in Michoacan. I'm going to buy one lot here, one lot there. And then I'm going to save, you know, six bottles of each lot. And then every year, and maybe in 10 years, I'm going to have a really wonderful collection. I mean, we have to obviously respond to the market and survive as a business. But also really encourage people to take more of an interest in a particular producer or a particular region.
Where can people find Neta mezcals in the States?
You can't find them yet because, as I said,
you're still working on the licensing.
I'm still working on the licensing. But hopefully soon in California, which is where we have our American company.
And
that's our main market again. Like, we can't service the entire world, but we choose a place where we also belong and have community.
Yeah.
And that's a place where Max has been established for a long time. And so.
Okay. Well, this will be a race then. Your licensing versus our publishing. Maybe we'll get there around the same time when we publish this episode. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. It's a fascinating moment for this business, and it's cool to see you here doing it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Nikki. The Trip is hosted by me, Nathan Thornburg, produced by Josie Holtzman and Danielle Roth of Future Projects. Our editor is Roads and Kingdoms, Taffy Mukunyadze. Our executive producers are me and Matt Goulding, also of Roads and Kingdoms. Special thanks to Dan the Automator for the music and to Adele Rodriguez for the art.
Next Monday, the trip continues its improbable bounce around the world. We'll be in Europe, talking with talented writer and editor Alexa Van Sickle about how to drink your way through her native country of Austria. We'll meet you there.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.